Pleased to present The New American Television. This program is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today's Thursday, May 18th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. We continue to learn about the massive corruption within the FBI and among federal legislators. The House Judiciary Committee Select Subcommittee on the Weaponization of Government is holding riveting hearings today featuring three whistleblowers who have questioned the politicization and weaponization of the FBI. All three agents, Mr. Boyle, Mr. Friend, and Mr. Allen, were suspended without pay, their security clearances revoked, and had their health benefits taken away. Garrett O'Boyle, a former police officer from Waukesha, Wisconsin, who was also a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan before becoming an FBI special agent, was transferred across the country to a new assignment in Quantico, only to have his clearance suspended and all his belongings seized the day after he and his family arrived in Virginia. Because of an arcane FBI policy, he's being forbidden from getting any new employment, leaving him and his family without income and without health insurance. In the early going of the explosive hearing, it was revealed that Democrats had not only ignored such whistleblowers while in control of the House, they also intimidated them and leaked many of their claims to the media. This pattern of conduct carried over into the contentious hearings, with Democrats repeatedly leveling personal attacks against the witnesses and Republican congressmen. Democrats accused them of racism, sympathy with domestic terrorism, trafficking in conspiracy theories, and shilling for Donald Trump and his re-election campaign. Congresswoman Stacey Plaskett of the U.S. Virgin Islands, the ranking member of the subcommittee, set the tone for what followed by characterizing the hearing as a circus for indulging conspiracy theories and speculations. She smeared Republicans as only interested in protecting the rights of white men, in spite of the fact that one of the three whistleblowers, Mr. Allen, is black. The pathetic spectacle included radical left Democrats literally shouting at witnesses and committee chair Jim Jordan, flagrantly violating House rules of order to accuse Republicans of the same and stirring up racial hatred. Even in the early going, it was obvious that the radical left Democrat faction, now in control of most federal government institutions, has zero respect for the sanctity of whistleblowers and stands unapologetically for the weaponization of government to maintain hold on power. As with previous hearings of this committee, the Democrats did little else other than discuss the events of January 6th and try to portray Republicans as so-called MAGA extremists who are sympathetic with domestic terrorists. So join me to discuss these bombshell hearings, executive senior editor of The New American, Steve Bonta. Wow, Steve.
Yes, wow indeed, Paul. That was my breakfast this morning. I woke up and began, well, the hearings are technically ongoing. They're in recess as we record this because they had to go vote on something else, so there could be more fireworks later in the day. But this is a continuation of what we saw in March, the last time the Special Subcommittee on Weaponization of Government held hearings, i.e., the Republicans were interested in exposing these really scurrilous machinations on the part of the FBI and other, you know, the Department of Justice as a whole. And the Democrats were only interested in politicking and portraying the Republicans as mean people. More than that, racists, domestic terrorists, insurrectionists, the whole nine yards.
All the things they are.
All the things they clearly and conspicuously are. As I said, I mean, you know, I just shook my head in disbelief at the opening statement of that you mentioned of Congresswoman Plaskett, who is one of the shrillest harpies on Capitol Hill, and you know, sat there yelling into the mic about how this was a travesty and how this is just, she called it a circus-like procedure or something like that, and then you know, openly accused the Republicans of being racists because they only care about white men who are being persecuted by the FBI. And one of the three witnesses sitting right there, very 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 fine, credible, articulate witness, I might add, as were all three of them were, in fact, is a black man.
Yeah, Mr.
Okay,
Allen.
No one seems to see the contradiction in that because it's the Democrats that are saying it.
So, they're so caught up in that narrative that they're so irrational that they discarded all appearances that are so clearly contradict this narrative, right?
Well, what has happened? And this was expressed very, I thought, very, very well by the second Democrat to speak, this Congresswoman Hagan. She said, you know, this whole thing really started post 9/11 under the Bush administration, ironically, okay, in which it was decided to effectively.
Hagan was a Democrat?
No, she's a Republican.
Okay.
But I'm saying that's my editorializing. It was ironic that all this started under President George W. Bush post 9/11 because, you know, what she said, and I think history clearly bears this out, was that a decision was made to transform the FBI from being primarily an investigative and perhaps a law enforcement agency, cooperating with local police forces and all that type of thing, into an information, an intelligence gathering organization, a domestic version of the CIA and the DIA and so forth and so on. And certainly, if nothing else, a domestic appendage of the CIA. And so surprise, surprise, that required a radical retooling of not only the way the organization works, but also a reconditioning of the entire organizational culture. And most recently, it was mentioned also in the hearings, about 2 years ago, sometime shortly after Biden became president, the order appears to have gone out informally to basically get rid of all FBI agents who clearly were political conservatives.
No
so there's
kidding.
Been an internal purge conducted. This has been mentioned before. You know, it has been alleged in the news media, but this was one of the many nuggets of truth that surfaced. So the FBI itself.
Let's back up. So are you saying that when Biden came in, the Biden administration took over, there was a purge of anyone with any remote?
That's what's being alleged. Yeah, that's taken place under Christopher Wray, this new administration. The rationale, of course, being that you can't trust conservatives because they're probably secretly sympathetic to the January 6th people.
Okay, and all three of these
witnesses.
That's how they would justify.
Well, all three of these whistleblowers, and apparently there were more than a dozen, or two dozen, I guess. There was a large number in all that congressional Republicans have interviewed. They chose these three, and it was easy to see why. I mean, they all acquitted themselves very well, or are acquitted. I mean, it's still ongoing, so I should use the present perfect. But anyway, they're all decorated military veterans, impeccable credentials. All of them have won, you know, medals and awards for their service and this kind of thing. The one that was most viciously attacked, particularly by Debbie Wasserman Schultz in the hearings so far.
She's still around?
She's still around, still making trouble. Anyway, his primary thing has been going after child pornographers and child traffickers. Okay, so a really good guy,
who is doing
one of the most maybe nauseating tasks that law enforcement people have to, namely tracking down the scum that hurt children.
The scummiest of the scum.
Yeah, the worst of the worst. So this is, and he came across, you know, just a thoroughly decent guy, and they're traducing him and accusing him of racism and of being a liar and all this type of thing. So all three, the common thread with these three and many of the other whistleblowers that have been interviewed also, is that they have questioned the way that the FBI has carried out its investigation so aggressively of people allegedly involved in January 6th, going far beyond people who are demonstrably on camera, smashing windows and committing, you know, other violent acts, to anyone who was alleged to be in D.C. that day to appear at the rally and using, you know, Stasi-like tactics against them, you know, storming their houses with SWAT teams and all the rest of the stuff, locking them up without access to counsel and all this sort of thing, right? And so these are men, I guess a small residue still left within the FBI, although they're not there any longer, who actually had the conscience to question this and say, you know, this isn't what we're about. And in fact, at least one of them himself has worked with a SWAT team and has a lot of experience on how SWAT teams are supposed to operate. And of course, the Democrats are saying they're lecturing them on how they're supposed to do their job and all this type of thing. It's just appalling. But what's happened has been that the Democrats have managed to, and by Democrats, I really mean the radical left faction that has, using the Democratic Party as its primary vehicle for achieving its aims. It's not exclusive. I mean, there are Republicans that are part of this too, but primarily the Democrats. Have managed to seize control of most of the levers of power in Washington, D.C., particularly these unaccountable bureaus that are not staffed by people that are elected by the voters. And now they're closing ranks and trying to reconfigure the system so that they can, you know, carry out their will without opposition. So, you know, they're obviously, understandably, just incensed. I have to say, on a personal level, though, I mean, it's a pathetic spectacle to watch these people who are completely, you know, obsessed with power, for whom the end emphatically justifies any means. You know, 30 years ago, almost 30 years ago, I was a big fan of a TV show called The X-Files, and there was this renegade FBI investigator named Fox Mulder, who was constantly getting in trouble because, you know, his whole mission, of course, he was worried about space aliens, but let's treat that as a metaphor. His mission was exposing this culture of secrecy and so forth. And at the time, it looked to be, it was good theater, because there were many, you know, many episodes where Mulder's in front of Congress and he's being grilled by hostile senators and congressmen who are being portrayed as these evil Machiavellian figures who just want to destroy him and all this sort of thing. And now we're seeing this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it reminded me, except for the fact that space aliens weren't mentioned, at least so far today.
Yeah, not yet.
It reminded me of a scene from The X-Files. You know, these three very clean-cut guys who obviously have exemplary careers and characters, good family men, the whole nine yards, record of service to country, being, you know, treated like they're the scum of the earth.
What are Republicans hoping to get out of this? Is there any chance that this could lead to policy change? I think we covered yesterday that there is talk of reauthorization of Section 702 and whatnot. That's kind of related, whatnot, maybe not. But what are we hoping to get out of this? What's the best?
To be honest, it's probably limited. They have limited options at this point, since they have control of a single branch of Congress.
Right.
And the entire administrative apparatus is that's why, for example, you know, the Department of Justice and the FBI are flagrantly disregarding their subpoena of various documents and saying, no, we're just not going to give it to you. Come and get them if you dare, that type of thing. I mean, they dare to do this stuff because they know they're in control. And it will take a pretty tectonic event, frankly, to the late, and by that I mean, you know, the elections next year would have to not only really shift things wholeheartedly to the Republican side, but the Republicans elected had better be, you know, a lot of them had better be,
they better be
the good kind, not the rhino kind.
And they better eat their Wheaties.
And they better have a supermajority or something close to it in the Senate, or they're not going to be able to do anything. The Democrats will continue to obstruct, aided and abetted by this vast network of powerful allies that they now have throughout the intelligence community, throughout the Department of Justice, and all of the organs of power in Washington, D.C.
I'd imagine the best thing that could come out of this is a massive swaying of public opinion.
Precisely.
Which then would bring, you know, would change things in the election, and then would pressure. That seems to be the best thing that could come out of this. Thank you, Steve. Thank you for keeping up on this, and I'm sure that we'll be following up on it next week, and you'll keep on to it, and we'll definitely provide more on this as we learn more. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
I certainly would not want a constitutional convention. I mean, whoa. Who knows what would come out of that?
It isn't the Constitution that's the problem. It is the people who ignore the Constitution.
What we need are just more people that would read the one we have.
It's up to us to hold our elected officials accountable.
Who understand the Constitution and are willing to take a stand when necessary.
Welcome back. We at The New American are excited to cover the World Council on Health's The Better Way Conference in Bath, UK. TNA senior editor Veronica Karolinko will be there reporting live, and she'll be hosting two panel discussions. Please visit betterwayconference.org and get your tickets. You don't want to miss this. Now, let's look at our other two stories. So Carrie Lake has not given up. The former TV anchor's claim that she was cheated out of the governorship is moving forward in court. The Arizona Republican never conceded her loss of the 2022 gubernatorial race to Democrat Katie Hobbs. Lake's lawsuit contesting the 2022 election results began yesterday and continues through tomorrow. She claims that irregularities prevented her from winning in the state's most populous county, Maricopa, which is home to more than 60% of the state's voters. The court originally threw out her lawsuit, but the Arizona Supreme Court ordered a trial to review signature verification procedures for mail-in ballots. Lake's attorney, Kurt Olson, accused the county of falsely verifying signatures. He pointed out that the rate at which they were reviewed and approved was physically impossible.
Over 274,000 ballots were approved at less than 3 seconds each. That includes one signature verifier who approved 100% of the 26,900 signatures that he verified at less than 3 seconds a signature. Maricopa's log file data shows that 11 of these signature verification workers approved 170,000 signatures at a rate of less than between 0 and 2.99 seconds with a 99.97% approval rating. That's not signature review, Your Honor.
Olson questioned 334,000 mail-in ballots that were effectively unverified in the 2022 election. Hobbs beat Lake by only 17,000 votes. He also said that level two reviewers who double-checked the rejected ballots of level one staff were so overwhelmed that they simply kicked them back to level one for analysis. Witnesses verified this claim. One of them, a whistleblower named Jacqueline Onakite, who worked during the primary and general elections last year, gave incredible testimony about her curing work. Curing is a process by which voters are contacted to fix problems with their ballots.
We ended on, would have been Tuesday the 14th at noon, they had us go home, which Wednesday was the last day at 5. So we didn't understand why we were leaving early when there was ballots left in the bins. And we had asked the manager, are you sure that you want us to go home? Would you like us to, you know, keep trying to call these voters to get these ballots cured? And they said no.
Onakite also accused the county of neglect regarding oversight of the review and curing processes. She said staff worked with zero accountability in an environment that was wide open to abuse and fraud. Another witness testified that he saw 298,000 mail-in envelopes that were processed in only 36 hours, which he called impossible.
We really didn't start to see any of the election night return information or data until probably Wednesday afternoon. And then by Friday, it was done. We all 298,000, we were done with it is what we were told, which made no sense. If we could only do 60,000, 70,000 a day, you know, we surely couldn't have done that in 36 hours is basically what it was.
The case continues through Friday. And one of Warren Buffett's shareholders landed in jail for calling out the business tycoon's leftist politics. It happened earlier this month at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting in Omaha, Nebraska. Peter Flaherty was given 3 minutes on the agenda to present a shareholder proposal. It was the same speech that he had published publicly one day earlier on the website of the National Legal and Policy Center, for which he serves as chair. In it, he argued that because Buffett is the chairman and CEO of the multinational conglomerate, its shareholders risk reputational harm due to its radical leanings. Flaherty began by establishing Buffett's ties as a major funder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and its politicized philanthropy. But when Flaherty mentioned Gates' ties to Jeffrey Epstein, it became obvious that he had entered a no-fly zone. Let's watch.
If woke culture is the disease, then philanthropy is the virus. The Gates Foundation bankrolls the teaching of critical race theory around the country, including that math is inherently racist. The Gates Foundation offers a gender identity toolbox, which asserts that gender is a result of socially and culturally constructed ideas. This is a lie. Gender is not a cultural construct. It is a genetic and biological fact. You're not going to censor what I say, ma'am. I'm very sorry. And I'll appeal to the chair that I be allowed to continue. Sir?
You may continue, but you're under a three-minute limitation.
Of course. We know how much Bill Gates cares about children. He met and traveled with Jeffrey Epstein many times after Epstein's convicted of sex crimes. The Gates Foundation had a huge influence on the COVID response fiasco. The Gates Foundation may be the largest single donor to the dark money machine known as Arabella Associates.
We don't.
It funds causes like defunding our police,
personal assault,
making American cities unlivable.
Well, somebody
money goes also to groups conducting threats.
Flattery. Officials cut his mic. Oh, let's try it again. Sorry. Just go. Officials cut his mic and told Flattery that he had to leave. He protested and said he hadn't finished his statement, but an Omaha police officer arrested him and dragged him out of the arena to jail. A couple of days later, Flattery described what happened on the Mark Levin show.
But I was led from the arena. I was transported downtown by two more cops. I was searched. I was handcuffed. I was charged. I spent about 3 hours there. I finally bailed myself out. And I was a free man again.
What were you charged with?
I was charged with criminal trespass, which is a curious charge. I was on the agenda. Now, it is true that Berkshire Hathaway had control of the arena and had their security there. But they are a public company with public shareholders who have rights. It's not... They don't have total control over the meeting. It's subject to the laws of Delaware, the corporate laws in Delaware, where Berkshire Hathaway is incorporated. It's also subject to regulation by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Mark, I've been a shareholder activist for 19 years. I've never had my mic turned off, and much less being arrested. And I've never heard of any other shareholder activist ever having that happen to them. This is unprecedented.
It's ironic that Buffett himself is credited with nicknaming the annual Berkshire Hathaway event as the Woodstock for capitalists. On the other hand, the National Legal and Policy Center is a nonprofit watchdog dedicated to exposing corruption in public and private sectors. Flattery believes he was falsely arrested and the victim of malicious prosecution. He told Levin that his general counsel is looking into suing. Flattery's full statement to Berkshire Hathaway is available at nlpc.org. Interestingly, according to its quarterly report to the SEC released Monday, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has sold 20% of its Berkshire Hathaway stock this year, though Benzinga says it could reflect a potential shift in the foundation's investment strategy. Berkshire still represents nearly 17% of Gates' holdings, down from just over 21%. Interesting time, Steve. Holy moly.
Indeed. Well, let's see. Regarding Arizona, I mean, this is another potential inflection point because, I mean, for a long time, it looked as if all of the courts were going to close ranks around, you know, the new governor and against Katie Hobbs, even though it was very clear.
And against Carrie Lake.
Carrie Lake. Yeah. Katie Hobbs is the governor against Carrie Lake. They both... Both begin with K, so I get confused. But anyway, yeah. So the essence in the early going, you know, they would submit their findings, you know, just unimpeachable, vast amounts of unimpeachable evidence of all these irregularities. And the initial response of the Maricopa County Court was something like, "Oh well, you know, but you haven't proven malign intent." Well, you don't have to do that according to Arizona law. Okay, the courts were doing these legal gymnastics to try to keep her from doing it. And that's not surprising because, you know, Maricopa County, people think Arizona, and I speak as someone who used to live in Tucson, that Arizona is this bastion of rock-rib Republican conservatism and all that. And in many precincts it is. But Maricopa County, be it remembered, is essentially the private property of, you know, the McCain Republicans. That's where John McCain came from, and you know, of not so blessed memory, and so he was a rhino's rhino. So he's hardly going to be sympathetic if he were alive today. He and obviously his living epigones are not going to be at all sympathetic to Carrie Lake because they want to try to purge the Republican Party of people like that. Yeah. So that's the problem.
Yeah.
As far as the other story is concerned, you know, there's this widespread mythology that all billionaires are sort of these Ayn Randian libertarian idealists committed to, you know, free enterprise and all this, and nothing could be farther from the truth. There are some who are,
yeah,
but for the most part, men who manage to get to that point seem to instinctively decide once they get there, okay, how can I enlist the power of government to insulate me from would-be competitors and industry entrants?
That's been the case for a long time.
And sure.
That was Dr. Anthony Sutton's main premise in a lot of his research, right?
Well, sure. And you know, Murray Rothbard was pointing this out decades ago, that we have a false view of what these guys are like.
Yeah.
Okay, so Warren Buffett, he may have started out that way many decades ago as an idealistic young investigator. He is emphatically one of them today.
Thank you, Steve. That's all for our news segment today, folks. For more Truth Behind the News, make sure to get a subscription to the New American Magazine, where you can do so at thenewamerican.com, or you can call our office at 800-727-8783, Monday through Friday from 8 to 5 Central Time. And stay tuned, because after this, we'll be showing Alex Newman's latest Behind the Deep State, where he documents some of our leaders' dependence on the Council on Foreign Relations and introduces us to a longtime insider who pledges to extend the CFR's reach even further and continue the group's influence over state and local policy.
Hello, I'm Brandon House. Several years ago, I worked with a team of experts and we developed Extractgevity. Extractgevity is an all-natural energy and health supplement. An all-natural energy and health supplement. I take it every day and I have for years. It comes in a powder form, you mix it with water and enjoy. It includes bilberry extract, grapeseed extract, red wine extract, and pine bark extract, along with vitamin C. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. Go do your own homework on the benefits of these supplements. And then you can order it at WVWTVstore.com, or you can call 901-468-9357. That's 901-468-9357, or at WVWTVstore.com. I've been taking it every day for years. In fact, a lot of times in the afternoon, I take a glassful because it is that all-natural energy and health supplement. Now, of course, I got to throw out that disclaimer that this product has not been approved or evaluated by the FDA, is not intended to treat, cure, or prevent any disease. But we invite you to check it out at WVWTVstore.com and enjoy Extractgevity, just as I do every day.
Joe Biden's deep state boss is stepping down very soon. But don't worry, the new boss will be the same as the old boss. Stay tuned and I'll tell you more. Welcome, everybody, to Behind the Deep State. I'm your host, Alex Newman. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you watch this show regularly, if you tune into this podcast, you already know who Joe Biden's boss is. And I'm not referring necessarily to the Prince of Darkness, but rather the guy Joe Biden identified as his boss at a strange event put on by the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, you've probably seen the clip of Joe Biden bragging about how he weaponized $1 billion U.S. dollars in foreign aid to get the prosecutor ousted, who just so happened to be investigating Burisma Holdings, the corrupt energy company that his son had just been appointed to sit on, his crackhead son, Hunter Biden, had just been appointed to sit on the board of, for $50,000 a month. Yeah, very, very bizarre. But earlier on in that strange event, Joe Biden maybe inadvertently revealed who his real master was. First, we'll watch the clip of Joe Biden talking about how he weaponized $1 billion in foreign aid. Watch.
That was the assignment I got. I got all the good ones. So I got Ukraine. And I remember going over convincing our team, or others, to convincing us that we should be providing for loan guarantees. And I went over, I guess, the 12th, 13th time to Kyiv, and I was going supposed to announce that there was another $1 billion loan guarantee. And I had gotten a commitment from Poroshenko and from Yatsenyuk that they would take action against the state prosecutor, and they didn't. So they said they were walking out to press conference. Said, "Nah," I said, "I'm not going to, we're not going to give you the $1 billion." They said, "You have no authority. You're not the president." The president said, I said, "Call him." I said, "I'm telling you, you're not getting $1 billion." I said, "You're not getting $1 billion. I'm going to be leaving here." And I think it was, what, 6 hours? I looked, I said, "I'm leaving in 6 hours. If the prosecutor's not fired, you're not getting the money." Well, son of a bitch. Got fired. And they put in place someone who was solid at the time.
And now Joe Biden, prior to that, admitting who his real boss was. Check it out.
Probably should introduce myself to people, everybody. My name's Richard Haass, by the way. I work here at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I work for Richard.
So Richard Haass, he works for Richard. Well, Richard was the head of the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, if you're watching this when we put it out, he still is the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, but he will be stepping down very soon. That's part of what I want to talk about today. But lest you think that Joe Biden is the only one who is taking orders from Richard Haass and the rest of the clown car at the Council on Foreign Relations, here is Hillary Clinton, then Secretary of State, admitting that the Council on Foreign Relations tells her what she should be doing and how she should be thinking about the future. Watch.
Thank you very much, Richard, and I am delighted to be here in these new headquarters. I have been often to, the mothership in New York City, but it's good to have an outpost of the council right here down the street from the State Department. We get a lot of advice from the council, so this will mean I won't have as far to go to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future.
And lest you get the mistaken impression that this is just Democrats who are taking their orders from the Council on Foreign Relations, let us go to Darth Vader, better known as Dick Cheney, fake Republican, vice president under George W. Bush, also father of Rhino Liz Cheney. Watch.
Pete, I want to thank you all for the warm welcome today. I see a lot of old friends in the room. And it's good to be back at the Council on Foreign Relations. As Pete mentioned, I've been a member for a long time and was actually a director for some period of time. I never mentioned that when I was campaigning for re-election back home in Wyoming, but stood me in good stead. I valued very much my experience and exposure to the tremendous people involved. And
yes, I never tell the suckers back home in Wyoming when I'm running for re-election. No, you wouldn't do that, would you? Now, the New American actually interviewed Dick Cheney decades ago. Very, very strange individual. But he's, of course, part of this cabal. Now, Richard Haass, he has led the Council on Foreign Relations since 2013. So he's been at the helm of this abomination of an organization. I call it Deep State Headquarters in the United States for over a decade. He's been working there for two decades. And before we get into some of the details of his replacement, our own Evan Mulch, field director for South Carolina and some of the East Coast, great, great man. He was actually able to ask Richard Haass some questions on a CFR webinar. It's a little bit of a long clip, but I want you to check it out. It's absolutely hilarious. So this is Richard Haass being questioned by a field coordinator for the John Birch Society. Watch.
I'm Evan Mulch. Some would say the Council on Foreign Relations has been made up of architects of the New World Order, especially since the founder of the council was Edward Mandel House, a man that was very proud of his plan to convert America into a one-world socialist state, or a socialist state under the one-world order. This is very well understood if you read the book Shadows of Power by James Perloff. Richard Haass, what is your thoughts on that? Do you think that the Council on Foreign Relations has been an organization made up of architects to form a new world order and to get rid of the sovereignty of the United States of America?
Short answer is no. A slightly longer answer is the Council on Foreign Relations, we are, by the way, celebrating our 100th year this year. We were formed by a bunch of largely Northeastern-based businessmen and lawyers in the aftermath of World War I. Their agenda was to see that the United States did not slip into isolationism, wanted the United States to join the then being formed League of Nations, obviously failed. President Wilson failed at that. And over the last 100 years, the council has evolved significantly. It's a national membership organization with about 5,000 members. It doesn't accept any money from this or any other government. It is genuinely nonpartisan. We have members from multiple political parties, Democrat and Republican allied, as well as people who are independents or unaffiliated. As Irina said, we have a think tank. We publish Foreign Affairs magazine. We have members and we meet. We're increasingly an educational institution, turning out materials to help high schools and college teach students about the world. We do not have an institutional position on issues. I have my own personal position on just about every issue, but the council itself does not. I think American sovereignty is a fact. I think sovereignty, the emergence of sovereignty in the 17th century was a great innovation. One of the reasons that there's been a degree or modicum of order in the world over the last few hundred years, despite two world wars, is because of sovereignty. I think sovereignty is a really healthy thing. And what sovereignty has done is given countries great latitude to conduct themselves as they wish within their own borders. It has led countries to respect borders, to agree to the principle that borders ought not to be changed by force. Now, obviously, there are times in history when that isn't respected and conflict results. We've just had the problem in our own country where our sovereignty has not been respected in the last two electoral cycles by Russia. And that is something for the Biden administration to deal with. But as someone who's been lucky enough to be the leader of this organization, the president of it for 17 and a half years, I see stable international relations as totally consistent with sovereignty. I think sovereignty is a necessary principle for there to be order in the world. When you people raise questions of New World Order, I would simply say, and it gets at what I was talking about before, I think there's an interesting question out there at this moment in history. We have things like infectious disease that's now created conditions where nearly 2 million people around the world have died, nearly one-fourth of them in our own country. Climate change. We've had the hacking that the Russians have just carried out. We have global terrorism. We have a North Korea with a growing number of nuclear weapons and missiles that can bring those nuclear weapons here. So the question I have is, how do we manage these threats in the world? And we can't manage them by ourselves. So to me, one of the challenges to the United States is how do we collaborate, coordinate with others, principally our partners and allies in Europe and Asia, but potentially elsewhere, to deal with these global challenges that don't respect borders. That's a fact of life. And the question is, can we develop new arrangements that are better able to contend with these challenges that don't respect borders, including things like viruses, be they computer viruses or physical viruses? So I would think that's very much in our interest. Now, we have the sovereign right to participate in those efforts or to reject those efforts. That's totally up to us. But I think on balance, we would be better served, depending on the details of the efforts, to participate them. But that is what foreign policy is all about. It's to make those choices.
So isn't that interesting? Richard Haass claims, no, we're not really looking for global socialism, before explaining why we actually need global socialism to deal with climate change and computer viruses and non-computer viruses and global terrorism. And no mention of the fact that CFR members have been instrumental in creating, funding, arming, radicalizing terrorist movements all over the world. Now, we don't talk about that. The new guy stepping in here, his name is Michael Froman. This was announced in March. And the Council on Foreign Relations says Froman is going to be extending the reach of the CFR to a broad set of constituencies across the country. That's what they said in their press release. Well, who is Mr. Froman, who's going to be extending the reach of the CFR into a broad set of constituencies all across the country. And they are, right? They're reaching now for state governments, for local governments, for education policy. They are absolutely everywhere. Froman is a big-time globalist. He's been a fellow at the CFR for some time. He was a fellow at the tax-funded German Marshall Fund of the United States. He got a Fulbright scholarship. He was a Ford Foundation Fellow in international law. He was at the MacArthur Foundation, the Social Science Research Council Fellowship in International Peace and Security, and a White House Fellowship and a Truman Scholarship. So he has been around the deep state globalist block more than once, if you know what I mean. And he is, according to the CFR, an internationally recognized expert at the intersection of foreign policy, national security, and international economics. Man, that sounds prestigious. His expertise, the CFR says, is the result of a decades-long career across the highest levels of government in the private sector, as well as nonprofits, academia, including serving as a distinguished fellow at the CFR. Now, Froman has been around, like I mentioned, many CFR entities for a very long time. He played a key role in the Clinton administration, working for CFR, longtime CFR veteran Robert Rubin. He served as Deputy National Security Advisor for International Economic Affairs back in the 90s, also under Clinton. He spent time as Rubin's chief of staff at the Treasury, and then they both took off for Citigroup after finishing their government service. Now, Froman also worked in the Obama administration. He was the deputy assistant at the National Security Council, and then he became U.S. Trade Representative. And one of his jobs as U.S. Trade Representative was to work on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, we have talked quite a bit about the globalist strategy for regional government before you get to global government. Klaus Schwab is a Mr. Great Reset. He admits this in his book on the Great Reset. He talks about how people are so upset with globalization right now. We're going to have an in-between. He calls it a solution, and that is, of course, regional government, with the European Union being, of course, the premier example. So Henry Kissinger, in his lame 2014 book, World Order, and of course, Kissinger is the one who recruited Klaus Schwab, and of course, Kissinger was recruited himself by David Rockefeller, the guy who bragged in his book that he was conspiring with a secret cabal against the best interests of the United States to build a more integrated one-world political and economic structure, a one-world order, if you will. That's on page 405 of his crummy autobiography. But so Kissinger explains in his book, World Order, which outlines the globalist strategy for world order. He says, the contemporary quest for world order will require a coherent strategy to establish a concept of order within the various regions and to relate these regional orders to one another. And so he believed NAFTA was the most creative step toward a new world order. The European Union, of course, was a big one. They're now imposing an African Union on the Africans. They've got an association of Southeast Asian nations they're imposing on the Southeast Asians. Of course, Putin is building his own Eurasian Union. Putin and Kissinger, by the way, are like two peas in a pod. Here's Kissinger talking about the New World Order. They've always got these creepy, creepy accents.
When really a New World Order can be created, it's a great opportunity. There's a need for a New World Order. Between four visions of world order.
So it's all part of the New World Order, as they tell you. But back to the Council on Foreign Relations, folks. Froman was the architect, or at least one of the key architects, of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP. So the TPP was literally the very essence of Kissinger's strategy. So you've already got these regional orders emerging, and now you have to find ways of relating these regional orders to one another. So on the Atlantic side, they were trying to relate the emerging North American Union, first with NAFTA, later with USMCA, to the European Union through a transatlantic trade and investment partnership. Well, on the Pacific side, they want to merge the U.S., Canada, Mexico with the other Pacific nations, including Communist China, incidentally, in Japan, and et cetera, through this TPP. Now, we reported very extensively on this at the New American. This was an abomination of an agreement. It would have radically undermined U.S. sovereignty. It would have set up kangaroo tribunals over all the nations who had been sucked into this. It would have set up international bureaucracies across the Pacific Rim. So total disaster. Now, thankfully, Donald Trump pulled us out of that monstrosity. But that is where Mr. Froman comes from, right? He is a technocrat, a minion of these deep state. And don't think that the head of the CFR is the mastermind, right? The head of the CFR is a technocrat. He's a puppet. He's an employee, just like Joe Biden. He's not the mastermind of all this, but he is kind of high in the pecking order. I mean, he's not David Rockefeller, who's now rotting in hell, but he is reasonably high up in the pecking order. And so He proved his loyalty by negotiating things like this TPP. He was named to the board of directors for Disney, right? So he's proven his loyalty to grooming and sexualizing and perverting our children. Apparently, he's still on the Disney board. I don't know whether he'll stay there as he moves over to the CFR. The CFR has got tons of corporate members, too, by the way, and they own most of the media in America and all the rest of it. But Froman, slave to big business, slave to big government, slave to the globalists, slave to the deep staters. And he has proven his loyalty over a period of decades to surrendering the sovereignty of the United States, destroying America as we have known it, and building this one world, new world order, as all the creepy globalists love to say. So Froman, in the press release from the CFR, says he's honored to have the opportunity to lead the Council on Foreign Relations. Yeah, I bet he is. And to work with its distinguished scholars and staff and members to maximize the impact of the United States. Yes. He says, as the world faces the return of great power politics. Yeah, thanks, CFR. That's what you get for building up communist China over a period of multiple decades, as you yourselves have admitted. But he says, as we return to this great power politics, the challenge of growing authoritarianism. Yeah, speak about building growing authoritarianism and the urgency of climate change. CFR, he says, has a critical role to play in fostering dialogue among people with differing perspectives. Oh, wouldn't it be nice if that were all that they were doing? Now, Richard Haass, the globalist, he actually praised Froman. He said the CFR is one of the crown jewels of America. Yeah, I guess of the American subversive movement, perhaps. He says the need for its educational offerings and serious policy-relevant nonpartisan analysis is arguably greater than ever. We are thus fortunate and then some to have someone with Mike Froman's experience, knowledge, and demeanor to lead the council into its second century. And it is its second century. It was formed a little over 100 years ago. Actually, it was formed primarily to suck America into globalist institutions. Our U.S. Senate voted overwhelmingly against the crazy League of Nations. Our senators had some wisdom back then. And so the round table groups, the Cecil Rhodes folks funded by his crazy fortune, decided that America needed a Council on Foreign Relations type organization that would help lead us into the new world order. These CFR hacks, they are all up and out. They are totally embedded into the Biden administration, just like they were embedded into virtually every administration of my lifetime. And then some. There was less during Trump's administration. Even in the Reagan administration, unfortunately, it was just totally packed with CFR hacks, including his vice president, George H.W. Bush. But here's a list of some of the CFR notables within the Biden administration. Janet Yellen, U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. Anthony Blinken, Secretary of State. Lloyd Austin, Secretary of Defense. Wow, all of the key positions are taken up by CFR members. What do you think the odds are of that? I would love to know. Now, we got some other ones. Biden recently announced General C.Q. Brown to be the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, also a CFR member. And yeah, so there are just tons of these folks at the highest levels of Republican and Democrat administrations. And we shouldn't be surprised by that, right? They are basically the American tentacle of what Dr. Carol Quigley, the historian at Georgetown University, who really agreed with all this, who was a mentor to Bill Clinton, said was the this international effort to, in his words, form a one world economic and political system run based on feudalistic principles where you will own nothing and you will be happy. Now, I want to just before we end on this CFR, I want to share with you a little bit of insight into how evil and how subversive the Council on Foreign Relations is. Now, I was looking back through my old articles and I wrote in 2013 an article about the Council on Foreign Relations, then newly appointed director of Latin America. Latin American Studies. Her name was Julia Swig. And you almost couldn't make this stuff up, folks. Julia Swig was, among other things, exposed thanking convicted communist terrorists in her books, calling for more attacks on the Second Amendment. And of course, she had numerous close associations with the mass murdering, extremely brutal dictatorship enslaving the people of Cuba. You had numerous people tracking Cuban spies for the U.S. government who actually suggested that Swig was an agent of influence, if not a spy, for Castro, for this murderous dictatorship right off of our shores. So how did she end up at the head of the Latin America program at the Council on Foreign Relations? Well, that really takes you to a true understanding of the CFR, folks. She is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the network of subversives that have been working through the Council on Foreign Relations to aid tyranny, to overthrow U.S. allies who are friendly to our country, Swig, of course, was very close to numerous members and leaders of the Foro de Sao Paulo. This is the communist Latin American network that now dominates that region. It was founded by Castro, founded by Lula, the Marxist president of President of Brazil, who just stole that election, the Sandinistas, the mass murdering communists in Central America, and of course, an army of Marxist narco terrorist organizations like the FARC, like the ELN, and others. So details about Swig. She also serves as the Council on Foreign Relations Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies were reported by a number of different places. And what they found was that as far back as 2010, she had been exposed for these horrific things. One of the things that she did in her book, she actually praised convicted Cuban terrorists. She had a book called Inside the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro and the Urban Underground. And she said, in Cuba, many people spent long hours with me, helped open doors I could not have pushed through myself, and offered friendship and warmth to myself during research trips to the island. She mentions Elsa Montero and Jose Gomez Abad, who championed this project. Well, those are actually two terrorists for the Cuban regime who in 1962 were busted plotting to murder thousands of innocent Americans with bombs in New York. Thankfully, the FBI, back when it was a legitimate law enforcement agency, was able to foil that plot. Thousands of Americans would have been dead thanks to the people that Julia Swig, director of Latin American stuff at the Council on Foreign Relations, was thanking in her book. Okay. Truly amazing, folks. Truly amazing. And there are so many of these people, right? One of the guys who marketed Fidel Castro to the American people, his name was Herbert Matthews. He was a propagandist, a fake journalist at the New York Times, who pumped out endless propaganda about Fidel Castro being an anti-communist freedom fighter. And Fidel Castro was the George Washington of Latin America, right? This is the garbage that they were feeding to our people. Of course, our whole State Department, while we were supporting Castro, was dominated by members of the CFR. And it's just how it is, folks. It's just how it is. Now, another interesting connection regarding Swig and the Castro regime, this came out in the Atlantic. These two writers visited Cuba. And thanks to Swig, Goldberg was able to secure an exclusive interview with the mass murdering dictator himself. Okay, Goldberg says, we shook hands, and then he greeted Julia warmly. They, as in Castro and Swig, have known each other for more than 20 years. How does a friend of a mass murdering dictator who oversees a regime that was on the state sponsor of terrorism list get to become the director of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations? See, the more you start to dig into this, the more these things start to make sense. Swig is just, she was so in the tank for the communist Cubans that Lieutenant Colonel Chris Simmons of the Defense Intelligence Agency, his job was actually uncovering and foiling communist Cuban plots. He publicly identified Swig as an agent of influence for the dictatorship. This was all before she was named as the head of Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, folks. So how this could be, I think really somebody needs to put these people under oath and ask some questions. They referred to Swig as a pro Che Guevara, pro Castro dissertation. That's what she was doing. She was granted special access to the Cuban regime's files, something that would never be possible for an objective scholar. According to the abstract of her dissertation, between 1995 and 1997, the Cuba Council of State, the highest governmental body in Cuba, permitted Julia Swig unprecedented access to the archival holdings of the Office of Historic Affairs. They would never, ever in a million years dream of doing that for an objective scholar, folks. This is what we are dealing with when it comes to the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the most murderous regimes on our shores. Somebody that's been spying on us and threatening us with terror attacks for so many years got to have a key post at the CFR. It's just unbelievable. Swig actually did an article for the CFR called Fidel's Final Victory. She said this, Cubans have not revolted and their national identity remains tied to the defense of the homeland against U.S. attacks on its sovereignty. Yeah, Cubans have not revolted because every time they do, they are tortured, they are murdered, they are disappeared, and so on. So that's what we're dealing with, folks. That's what we're dealing with. Now, Swig was actually at the Institute for Policy Studies before going over to the Council on Foreign Relations. The Institute for Policy Studies was basically a Marxist group, a Soviet front group. Representative Larry McDonald, a congressman from Georgia, who before being murdered by the Soviet Union, was actually taking the lead on some of these issues. He put into the Congressional Record that the Institute for Policy Studies is a consortium of Marxist new leftists organizing for a new economic and political world order and an America neutralized as a world power through a variety of tactics. Okay, that is in the Congressional Record. That was back in 1977. Swieg also worked at the ARCA Foundation, which was described by analysts as the pro-Castro lobby's sugar daddy. They're the people funding all of this, founded by tobacco heiress. They've been on the cutting edge of radical left-wing causes, embracing Fidel Castro's Cuba and the Palestinian cause and Saul Alinsky-inspired community organizing and the never-ending social justice campaigns of the left, according to Matthew Vadim, senior editor at the Capital Research Center and author of Subversion, Inc. Folks, this cannot be emphasized strongly enough. The CFR is working not just to undermine our sovereignty, but to undermine our economy, to build up the enemies of freedom and the United States. She and the CFR have consistently been working to further empower government, to further throw off the shackles of the Constitution, to aid and abet every subversive communist movement in the world. You can't make this stuff up. I actually interviewed James Perloff for this. He said, Swieg's intimacy with the Cuban government underscores the long-term continuity of CFR policy. That's what he told me. James Perloff, author of The Shadows of Power, The Council on Foreign Relations and the American Decline, one of the most important books ever written on CFR. He says, when Fidel Castro was only a fledgling revolutionary, it was Herbert Matthews' articles in the New York Times that persuaded Americans that Castro was anti-communist and democratic. This paved the way for Castro's rise to power with his brutal dictatorship and Soviet missiles aimed at America. So, folks, this is what we are dealing with the Council on Foreign Relations. It's hard to overstate the danger of this organization, even though it has penetrated the highest levels of power here in America. And, you know, we're only scratching the surface here, folks. If we had more time, we would go into much more depth. Swieg and so many others at the CFR, they've been the leading advocates of gun control, of the United Nations, of abortion, you name it. The CFR is on it. Now, one more note on Froman. You know, I told you he was big on this TPP and this effort to subvert U.S. sovereignty using these international agreements and trade agreements. Well, you know, the CFR, one of the things that they were working on very heavily was trying to subvert American sovereignty and merge us into a North American Union modeled on the European Union, where you'd have a North American parliament, a North American currency. In fact, we got the documents from this. In 2007, the U.S. ambassador, this was George W. Bush administration, the U.S. ambassador to Canada, Paul Carlucci, he actually put his hand, his signature on a document talking about how we could subvert sovereignty and constitutions to create a true North American bloc. And that's what they've been up to. But the late Professor Robert Pastor, he was also at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's often been described as the father of the North American Union. He was on the task force that was promoting this continental regime. Before he died, he wrote a book, and he actually credited the Eagle Forum, Phyllis Schlafly's organization, and the John Birch Society with stopping this subversive agenda for North America. So, folks, we need to redouble our efforts. The CFR is the linchpin of the deep state's operations in America. We need congressional investigations. We need the American people to know what is going on here. Larry McDonald actually tried to get some of this stuff investigated by Congress. Unfortunately, his plane was shot down before he was able to make real progress on that. But folks, if our country is going to survive absent some kind of divine intervention, the CFR is going to have to be exposed and their agenda is going to have to be stopped. Don't listen to their lies about we don't take policy positions. They've been driving U.S. policy, as Hillary Clinton explained, as Joe Biden explained, as Dick Cheney explained earlier on in the program. Thanks for watching. I'm Alex Newman. This is Behind the Deep State. Until next time, thanks for watching. And God bless you all.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And don't forget to visit thebetterwayconference.org and get tickets to this wonderful event, which is another reminder that freedom lovers around the world are coming together and demanding a better way. We will see you tomorrow.